My name is Enrique Vivoni. I'm here at Arizona State University. Welcome to Arizona and to the Phoenix metropolitan area. We'll speak today about unmanned aerial vehicles and their use for characterizing both urban and natural landscapes. This is, in fact, an image taken from a UAV above the Salt River. The Salt River is near the airport. Don't ask me how we did this, but this is a mosaic of the river wetlands next to the airport in Phoenix, in which you arrived here, most of you anyways. I spent a sabbatical last year in Baja California, Mexico, so I got to view the coastal zone, and the coastal zone all over California and Baja California is being urbanized. And this particular image, when I go back there a few years from now, I can guarantee you that this natural landscape will be entirely urbanized. Houses in all of the hills, not a fraction of the hills. Can we monitor then these changes using low-cost, frequent, investigator-based platforms? Now, UAVs, you're all familiar with them. They're becoming very popular for all sorts of tasks in sort of our modern world. These are some images taken by a paper by Anderson and Gaston in the ecological literature of examples of UAVs used for ecology. Everything from quadcopters to little parrots to flapping wing autonomous vehicles to airplanes of various types. Now, these is nice. The question is, are they useful? Are they useful for the types of science that we want to do in hydrology, in ecology, even in atmospheric science? And are they useful for numerical models of systems that we intend to inquire about? Here's an example of a UAV image mosaic taken over a study area. This happens to be an artificial xeric landscaping. Many of our trees here in Phoenix are watered. These are watered Palo Verde trees that are arranged by man in a specific pattern in a construction area. Here there's also an art installation, and flying over this site you can get all sorts of high resolution imagery of even individual shrubs within that particular art installation. So the capabilities in terms of resolving a natural or an urban landscape are very large and at very low cost. How does this work? Okay, well, you have a UAV or you have an aircraft that's flying and it's in motion. It has a camera. This camera is taking many, many snapshots as it's going through the motion. And it's observing targets on the land surface. As you can see here, we have like a tower on a digital elevation model. And as it's traversing this area, we're essentially doing stereo image analysis. Okay, this is called in the UAV literature structure for motion. So we can resolve not only the color of the landscape from a digital camera, but also the shape and the geometry of the landscape by viewing a target from multiple view angles. There's a workflow that's associated with the image processing. So the acquisition, which is the first step of flying the UAV, maybe autonomously or maybe flying it by human control, both are possible. Acquisition of these images, hundreds of these images, they're aligned. Features are detected within the image pairs. We generate a three-dimensional point cloud, X, Y, Z values with a color associated with them. These then have to be grounded, if you will, to the real coordinate system. So we need ground control points to georeference these three-dimensional point clouds. There are processes to classify points according, say, to their color or to their roughness or to their texture. And we can derive digital terrain models and ortho image mosaics that can be classified, for instance, according to land cover type, cement versus gravel cover versus building rooftop versus vegetation, for instance. And the resolutions are sort of phenomenal, 1 to 10 centimeters, depending on the height and the number of images acquired. where you can resolve, for instance, individual needles on a prickly pear frond. Okay? For those of you from Arizona, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what a prickly pear is, I can introduce you to one. They're nice cactus species. So we've conducted this type of work, image acquisition using different types of UAVs over natural landscapes. For instance, here in southern Arizona, the Santa Rita Experimental Range, and in southern New Mexico, the Jornal Experimental Range, because we have ongoing long-term hydrological and ecological experiments at these sites. We've also done some work in the Phoenix metropolitan area, where we've deployed short-term instrument networks, as pictured here. These towers are called the Eddy-Covarrubias Towers. A previous speaker spoke about their use for estimating carbon and water fluxes. So we're getting evapotranspiration and net ecosystem exchange at these urban and rural sites from these tower deployments. Now, some of them are fixed in space, and some of them are on a mobile trailer that can be moved around from place to place. As an example here, we're trying to coordinate our UAV image acquisition with instrument networks. The image shown here is a mosaic at 6 centimeter resolution over our watershed of interest. This watershed of interest has a tower, an Eddy-Covarrubias tower at the location T, and it has a network of soil moisture sensor profiles, which are the white diamonds arranged along different hill slopes. It has a network of internal runoff measurements, which are the green circles, and it has a rain gauge network, which are the blue triangles. Now, we installed those sensors without really knowing where the watershed was. Okay? So the watershed boundary in black was acquired from the UAV-generated DEM at 1 meter resolution, which then we can, okay, now we know which areas from this digital elevation model drain to our individual runoff measurements, and we know exactly where our soil moisture sensors are ranged along these hill slopes. So it's a very cool sort of use of UAVs to understand the study region of interest in more detail. Now, we did one on deployment in a parking lot area near the corner of Mill Avenue and University. This is in downtown Tempe, a college area with lots of bars and fun times. And there was a tower there for about 60 days where I'm sure people peered at it and said, "What is that?" You could see the tower from the UAV image. It's surrounded by a fence, a sort of a rectangular fence. We placed that in a gravel cover, and the footprint of this tower, in other words, the area that this tower measures, is primarily in that parking lot. And that parking lot had cars frequently. So we're measuring water, carbon exchanges, and energy exchanges in really an area that's anthropogenically high density. Lots of people and lots of cars and lots of building materials in place. At really unprecedented detail, you can select individual car features from these images. Now, the work that's allowed us to do the most quantitative efforts using these UAVs have been from these fixed, more expensive platforms. Okay, we have an autonomous helicopter in the lower left and an autonomous aircraft or airplane in the upper right. The airplane's launched from this catapult shown in A, and it lands in a dirt airstrip, whereas the helicopter has more ability to land and take off from any individual spot. And these have provided the sort of the more quantitative UAV type of science products that I'll show you in a second. A bit of the characteristics of these UAV platforms. They're owned by our collaborators and ourselves. They can carry fairly low payloads at the moment, and we've used them with sensors including digital cameras, thermal cameras, and in one instance a small LiDAR package. Now, there's an explosion of drones that are now available at Best Buy. Okay, you can buy a drone at Best Buy or at Walmart today, go outside. You find it for a few hundred dollars. These are cheaper versions of the types of instruments that we've used, but they're also quite useful, and I'll show you some images from those as well. So what I'd like to do in the time remaining is provide some examples of the image products and why they're useful, and then some of the science products derived from these images. Here's one example. In A, we had our digital elevation model that we knew prior to installing our sensor network at a site in New Mexico. This was about a 2-meter product. The elevation field wasn't very good at all. And we knew from a field survey, we had a sense of the black line, the watershed boundary. In B is our improved product based on the UAV-based elevation field in terms of both the elevation itself, the watershed boundary, the stream network, and even sub-basins that are draining upstream of each individual flume. So this is a phenomenal increase in our ability to characterize the topography of this experimental site. From B, one can derive all sorts of properties associated with terrain. For instance, the slope map. And in the slope map, we find those areas, the channel heads, for instance, that have high slopes are erosional features. We also determine from those the banks around individual channels. Of course, we can get other properties such as the terrain aspect. Terrain aspect in D would show us how different areas within the watershed might be receiving different radiation loads. Now, because these image mosaics are RGB color, and because we have access to the site, we can classify colors according to plant type. So we've done a high-resolution classification of plant type. A shows all of the plant types. There's about 6 or 7 of them. These are mostly shrub and grass species with a lot of bare soil background, something like 65% bare soil. We can then map the individual vegetation types. For instance, B, C, and D show in purple, red, and yellow individual plant types, Mariola, mesquite, creosote. And this reveals to us that the mesquite and the creosote happen to occupy similar spaces in the landscape, deep soils on flat surfaces. Those are the bottom two plots. They coexist, whereas they do not exist in the topography areas occupied by Mariola. Mariola tends to prefer sloped areas with shallower soils. We get to know the topographic location preferences of individual species by combining the topography with the classification of the species themselves. This is pretty phenomenal in my view. Now we can then, of course, calculate percentages of individual species for different areas of interest. So these three polygonal areas shown on the upper right are areas of interest for the experiment. We have the watershed polygon, we have the that's in black, we have a red, which is the area of influence around a Cosmos soil moisture sensor, and we have around blue the area of influence or the footprint around the eddy covariance tower. And then we can compute what number of what percentage of each species is in within each polygon. Gets us to understand if there are differences among our sampling for our different sensors. These footprints, eddy covariance footprints, as I mentioned earlier, are the regions around the tower that are sampled, okay, by the tower. They are dependent on wind speed and wind direction, and over seasons, one gets these maps shown in red and blue, colored contributions of individual pixels to the fluxes, carbon fluxes, water fluxes, energy fluxes, measured at the tower location, pictured here on the right-hand side. So over our deployment period, if we overlay our UAV imagery with these footprint estimates, we can tell which day of the year is being sampled in which piece of the landscape. Maybe the winds are coming from the south and we get a larger fraction of the tree cover. If the winds are coming from the north, we get a larger fraction of the building materials. That fraction of the footprint occupied by each land cover type influences the measured fluxes. And since this varies in time, these footprints vary in time, our map is static in time, we can associate measured fluxes with individual contributions by different land cover types. Again, because of the high resolution imagery afforded by the UAVs. So those are some examples of the image products. How are these useful for science? I'll talk about two cases. In the first case, it's a land-atmosphere interaction case. Okay? We have a tower noted by the green star. We have a series of soil moisture sensors profiles noted by the triangles. And then we have these footprints averaged over different seasons. Summer footprints for 2011 through 2013. And then the question is, does our footprint care about what land cover is within the footprint? Does the footprint care about what soil moisture or soil temperature is measured within the footprint? So one example of the work we've done at these two towers, one in New Mexico and one in Arizona, is to calculate the percentage of the footprint occupied by the different species. As a time series, this is shown on the left-hand side. Okay? And so we have a time series of the percentage of each day's eddy covariance footprint sampled by bare soil or occupied by mesquite, prickly pear, and so forth. I'll show you 2 days in the arrows, black and red, and notice that the polygons, black and red, correspond to those 2 days. In the black day, there's a large percentage of grass cover. That was a big grass patch located to the north of the tower. In the red day, there's a lower percentage of grass cover. That red polygon occupies a lot of mesquite trees and a much lower percentage of grass cover. You go to the evapotranspiration data, and you can actually detect a difference in evapotranspiration if the tower's viewing the grass versus viewing the mesquite. This is really cool, right? Because we can see individual contributions of land cover types to the total ET measurement at the tower site. And this is the type of thing that the UAV allows you to inquire about. Another example has to do with numerical modeling. Okay, here we use the UAV data to set up a model, a distributed ecohydrological model, that requires topography and it requires land cover classification. So the UAV measurements are processed to get an elevation field. In our case, are processed to get a domain, a triangular irregular network domain. Are then processed to get the vegetation type associated with each 1 meter grid cell or Voronoi polygon inside this domain. And we conduct hydrological modeling using these UAV products as input. So to get a sense of the outcomes of this, here's one example. These are the regions within these two watersheds in southern Arizona in the Santa Rita Experimental Range that generate infiltration excess runoff. Okay, this is over an entire summer season. The blue areas are pixels that contribute most to runoff generation. Okay, these happen to be associated with a particular land cover type. And so we are now converting UAV-based terrain and elevation products to UAV-based runoff estimation maps to give you a flavor of the utility of these new platforms. So, to wrap up, I believe that UAVs offer a new, I'll call it a self-service model, meaning that individual teams and researchers can purchase these low-cost instruments, readily learn how to deploy them, obtain the data at the frequency that they are intended with the turnaround that they intend, using commercially available platforms and software processing, and really help us do better science. Now, there are many challenges that remain, and I'll list a few of those. Can we ever get UAVs to match the extent of one satellite pixel? How many swarms of UAVs would you need to run in order to do that experiment? Can we extract more data using other types of cameras? Thermal cameras, for instance, are interesting to me. Okay, for instance, can that be related to the prior talk about the LST versus NDVI signal and getting soil moisture from the trapezoidal method using a UAV? When and how will other payloads be possible? If Amazon's going to deliver big boxes using drones, can I put something heavy on a drone? Something heavy, like to directly measure soil moisture somehow? And then, using these technologies, will we be able to update our knowledge of how land covers change? What is the human modification of the landscape? And can this technology help us to track it, monitor it, and maybe even improve our decision-making about it? So with that, I'd like to thank all of you for listening and our funding agencies for their support. the shelf. Now, the problem there is field validation of the RGB signal for that species type. So it requires, you know, a few hundred different samples of that particular plant.
Where did your estimates for the Honduran eddy covariance footprints come from?
That's a great question. There is several different analytical models. They're all two-dimensional, so they look like ellipsoids. Okay. So based on the height of the sensor, the roughness of the canopy, or what the canopy might be, it could be an urban canopy, and then velocity field that you observe at that site, these analytical models provide you for each 30-minute period what the ellipsoid is at that particular time. You do that over a whole day, you get a complicated shape. You do that over a whole season, averaging, you get an even more complicated shape. So sort of it's part of the processing of the eddy covariance flux data. I assume you can, not that we have, but for instance, I have undergraduates that do that process. So if an undergraduate with relatively little background can go through this procedure from flying the drone to getting the mosaic, I think it's fairly reasonable to expect to automate.
Well, thank you, Enrique.
Thank you.